Hey, everybody. Welcome back to one more episode of All Crime, No Cattle. I am one half of this podcasting duo, Detective Shea Butter.
And hello, I'm Erin. And you might have noticed that we are a few days late on this week's episode. And believe me, you've told us about it.
Mm-hmm.
We've gotten your messages and your comments. We get it. You're upset. But the whole reason why we are late this week is because we are migrating from our old hosting service and our old network to something new and different. So we had to wait for all of those processes to get aligned and for the sun to align with the moon and
yeah, we had to get our crystals out and we had to do a seance under a pyramid. It was a whole thing.
Yeah, it was all very obnoxious. But basically, we're all in our new home right now. Everything is great and moving forward. And I think it's going to be a better setup for us and for you guys as the listeners. So that's one thing. Our other little new thing that's going on right now is we have been in the process of commissioning new art. If you follow us on Facebook or any of our other social media, we have posted that new art and it's available now. You can see it. It's a little twist on our old logo, but it's something that's really new and special, we think. Would you like to tell everybody about the artist who made our new logo?
Yeah. First of all, big thanks goes out to our podcasting buddies, Gone Cold. They put us in contact with an amazing artist named Joel Micah Harris. And you can check out some more of his artwork at artofjomiha.com. Yeah, he's a really cool artist. He does a lot of neat comic book style pen art and hand-drawn things. We're super happy with it. I really dig our new logo. It has way more detail. Like you said, it's kind of like what we had going before, but way more professional. And I think you guys are going to love it. Tell us what you think.
Unless it's mean, and then don't.
Well, other than that, I think that's all of the cleanup out of the way. What is this, episode 35? Yeah.
Yes. It is. All right. Well, let's just jump right in. Why don't we? Sources at the top of the show. The biggest source for information about a lot of the specifics and about the trial comes from ABC 13 Eyewitness News. We also have articles that we're referencing from CBS News, the Houston Press, and the Houston Chronicle. Those are all really good sources of information. We also have a couple of TV shows based on this case. One is a show called Facing Evil. I couldn't find it for free, so I had to pay $1.99 on YouTube. And honestly, not worth it. It's a super biased representation of the facts of this case. So would not recommend that one. There was also an episode of Snapped about this case, and that was actually very well done. It is $2.99 on Amazon. So if you want more information, you can go there and check that out. Before we begin, I'd also like to mention at the top that there is some mention of child abuse in this case. It's certainly not going to be the worst thing you've ever heard, but I do want to give you the heads up. It's important to the case, and that's why we're going to talk about it today. Now, this was actually suggested to us by a listener, but unfortunately, I can't find who that person was. I searched our email, I searched our Facebook, can't figure it out. So if you're out there, let us know so we can give you your shout out on the show.
Yeah, do that. Hit us up. You know who you are.
Hopefully, there's like 16 people. They're like, it was me. But this is a really compelling story of abuse, sex, arson, and a bizarre love triangle that all culminated in a murder-for-hire plot.
Wow, that's a lot of things.
It is, certainly. So let's jump right into it because we got a lot to talk about.
Okay, I'm excited. You have my attention.
The story begins at the First New Mount Calvary Baptist Church. The church was located in the historic 5th Ward District just outside of downtown Houston, where it had stood for almost 100 years. This is the church that Tracy Burleson called home, the church he had attended all his life. And in 1994, it's where he met his future wife, Pauletta. The two quickly fell in love and were married in July of the following year. Pauletta and Tracy both had sons from previous relationships. Tracy's son, William Fuller, was about 6 when Pauletta became his stepmother, but he was 11 when he actually started living with them. I'm assuming he lived with his mother before this period.
Hmm, okay.
Over the next few years, Pauletta and Tracy also fostered and adopted 2 boys a little younger than their natural children.
A lot of children going on here.
Yeah, it's a full house. At an early age, Tracy's son William was diagnosed with sickle cell anemia. And real quick, we're going to have a little bit of a science corner. I know some people like our science-y segments on this show. So we're going to talk a little bit about sickle cell anemia and what it is and why it's even a thing.
Science.
Sickle cell anemia is a really interesting disease, so let's talk about what it means to suffer from it. So in a healthy body, red blood cells carry oxygen through your blood vessels, delivering it to the tissues throughout your body. Healthy red blood cells are kind of like a cream-filled donut in shape. They're kind of cute little buttons and they're flexible so they can race around the circulatory system and squeeze through branches and junctures and tiny little spaces just fine. But people with sickle cell anemia produce red blood cells that are irregularly shaped. They look like little crescent moons or sickles, which is how the disease gets its name. This is problematic for two main reasons. One, sickle cells are unstable and die quickly. Healthy red blood cells live for about 100 to 120 days, while sickle cells live only for 10 to 20 days.
Well, that's quite a difference.
Exactly. So this means that someone who produces sickle cells is usually very anemic. The second problem has to do with the shape of the cells themselves. The sickle shape can actually cause the cells to get stuck in smaller blood vessels, and they can dam up and cause blockages. This can cause intense pain, swelling, infections, strokes, and other conditions. So sickle cell anemia is a very painful and debilitating disease. But what's really super interesting about sickle cell anemia is the genetics and the evolution of the disease. So sickle cell anemia is the result of a mutation, which is a random change in a genetic sequence. Mutations are usually the result of errors made during DNA replication. Well, this particular mutation occurred in the gene for creating hemoglobin, which is basically the protein that allows red blood cells to carry oxygen. Now, mutations are usually one of three things. Most mutations are deleterious or bad because they can make a gene that works stop working the way it's supposed to. It's like that old adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Mm-hmm.
You take a normal genetic sequence and randomly jack around with it, a lot of the times the end result isn't going to be so good. Sometimes mutations can be neutral, meaning they really have no effect positively or negatively. But some mutations can actually be beneficial and give a surprising advantage. For example, the ability to digest lactose into adulthood is actually due to a mutation. So if you can drink milk just fine, you're a mutant just like me.
That's right. You are a mutant.
And you're just living in the past, buddy.
That's right.
With your lactose intolerance.
Hey, you know what? My people weren't supposed to suckle on the teat for milk after they were babies. And I'm okay with that.
Sickle cell anemia has an autosomal recessive pattern of inheritance, which all that means is you have to inherit the defective gene from both your mother and your father in order to develop the disease. If you inherit one defective gene and one normal hemoglobin gene, you're just a carrier of the disease and you don't really have any symptoms or bad stuff from the disease. But what you do have is a protective advantage against what, Shay?
I believe it's malaria.
That is right. Now, the reason why people who carry the faulty sickle cell trait are protected against malaria is really complicated, but the important thing to note is that this mutation can be bad, neutral, and good. It can be good for those people who carry only a single copy of the gene because it can protect against malaria, which even today kills over 500,000 people per year.
Yeah, malaria is a very scary disease, and I could see how having some sort of mutation and advantage to fighting off malaria would be very helpful.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why in certain places in the world where malaria is a huge real issue, this mutation is strongly selected for because of that advantage. Now, it could be considered neutral to some who carry the gene but live in an area where they're not really likely to contract malaria, like right here in Texas. And, of course, it can be bad for those few whose mother and father are both carriers of the disease and have passed the mutated gene on to them, causing full-blown sickle cell anemia. And so this is what William had. So this is a fascinating disease. Thank you all for coming to my TED Talk. I will now get back to the story.
Yeah, you're right. It is really fascinating, and it's a fun chance that we get to talk about how genetics and evolution work. So we're bringing you a little science with your true crime today, and I like that.
That's right. I love it, too. Well, in 2008, Tracy became ordained and became a pastor at the church he grew up in, fulfilling a lifelong dream. Pauletta took her role in the church and community very seriously. After all, here in the South, and especially in Baptist churches, the pastor's wife is a position of respect and power.
Definitely.
She's considered the first lady of the church, and she too becomes part of the face of the church. And so Pauletta was always there, front and center, every Sunday. Everyone knew her just like they knew Pastor Tracy. So far, this seems like the story of a happy and loving blended family that had their fair share of suffering, but took their responsibilities to their community to heart. But under the surface, and away from much of the congregation, things were not as they seemed, for this manufactured appearance of good, God-fearing people was cloaked in a darkness that would continue to build over the course of years. The first outside evidence of this came in 1997, when Pauletta pled guilty to abusing the couple's two adopted sons, who were only 3 and 4 years old at the time. According to Craig Malisaw of the Houston Press, Pauletta received deferred adjudication, meaning she basically pled guilty in exchange for serving 6 years of probation. Now, how you can get probation for child abuse is beyond me, but what's even more confusing is that the children were still left in her care.
That's very weird. I don't understand how any of that works.
Me either. Well, it gets worse, because then in December of 2005, both Tracy and Pauletta were charged with abuse of the two boys, who were then 11 and 12 years old. According to affidavits obtained by the Houston Press, the couple were accused of hitting the children with extension cords, an iron, a wooden board, and a shovel.
Holy crap.
Yeah, one of the boys told investigators that Tracy would make them put their head down, and then he would hit them on the back of the neck with a wooden board.
Ugh.
A witness gave a statement that he had seen Pauletta hit one of the boys in the head with a shovel and with her fists.
With a shovel?
Yes, with a shovel. And even with the boys' outcry, the multiple witness statements about abuse, and the multiple injuries and bruises on the boys' bodies, a grand jury declined to indict Pauletta and Tracy for child abuse.
On what grounds? It seems like there was plenty of evidence and information there to move forward with an indictment.
Absolutely. So, yeah, that's a really big question mark. But we have a third question mark, and that's because just 2 years later in 2007, Pauletta and Tracy were again arrested on 2 counts of injury to a child under 15. Tracy was released, but Pauletta pled guilty. What do you think her punishment was this third go-round?
Is it more probation?
She received deferred adjudication again with 3 years of probation. So actually half the probation time compared to what she received the first time she was accused of child abuse.
Is this just because of the position that they hold in their community?
Maybe.
Oh.
You know, yeah. It's very hard to understand why this is. And what's really weird is beyond just this one reporter who got access to all of these affidavits about this child abuse, this is not really talked about anywhere else. And I find that very interesting because this really sets the tone for what was going on in that house.
Were they sweeping all this under the rug and keeping everything really quiet? Or did the church know? Did the community know? I have all these questions. Because if you did, again, we always say, if you see something, say something. And that's ridiculous. Talking about pastors and a pastor's wife and evangelical churches in the South like this, definitely a very powerful, protected position. I know that from my mom's side of the family. We were Pentecostal, and there were some times where there were scandal or things going on in the church that kind of got swept under the rug. The rumor mill would get going, and you knew something was going on, but those kind of positions of power got protected, like you're saying.
Yeah, and that's a good point as far as these child abuse charges go. Was that the reason why nothing really happened? Was there this, you know, community outpouring of support for them, and so that it was kind of swept under the rug? Or was there this excuse of like, well, it's the culture of spare the rod, spoil the child, and this is being overblown? Yeah, those are a lot of really good questions that I don't have the answers to. But it's definitely an intriguing aspect of sort of setting up the atmosphere and the tension and the environment that all of this stuff goes down in later in the story.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, then there was Tracy's affairs. Yes, affairs with an S that he had throughout his marriage with Pauletta. In fact, one time Pauletta actually caught Pastor Tracy having sex with a member of the church choir in the church.
Whoa.
Yeah. This was an issue on many levels. First, Pauletta obviously threatened to leave Tracy, which would then put him financially in a strained spot, because as a restaurant manager, Pauletta was the one to actually contribute more to the household financially. She was the one really paying the bills, getting him set up with his fancy minister suits and, you know, really funding kind of their lifestyle.
Yeah.
So, you know, if she were to leave him, Tracy wouldn't be that well off.
No, you'd have to go to the thrift store to get all your fancy suits.
Exactly. But even more worrisome is that apparently Pauletta threatened to go to the church with the news of the affair. And in a lot of churches, adultery is cause for termination. And that was the case for the church that Tracy was a pastor of. So there were big stakes involved if Pauletta ever divorced him. He'd basically be ruined. So already we're seeing a lot of alleged violence and dysfunction in the home, plus a lot of shady stuff going on with Pastor Tracy at church. At the very least, some issues with abuse of power for a pastor sleeping around with members of his congregation. But then, on May 12, 2010, the church burned down. The fire started inside the church in the early morning and basically destroyed the building. The arson division of the Houston Fire Department launched an investigation into the fire immediately, but their findings were ambiguous and they couldn't confirm whether or not the fire was an accident or caused intentionally. Pauletta, in her role as First Lady of the church, can actually be seen in some of the news footage talking about the fire.
Interesting. What did she have to say?
It was basically like, well, this is really unfortunate, but with God, if we all trust in him, we can move forward, you know, blah, 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 that basic stuff.
But I'm guessing that something else is behind this fire since you brought it up.
Well, what wasn't shown on any footage was a strange thing that Pastor Tracy said to a fellow deacon at the church as they surveyed the wreckage. Tracy said, quote, "Now that the church is burned down, I've got one more thing to get rid of." But he didn't get to finish his thought because Pauletta approached them and Tracy quieted down.
Oh, that's nefarious sounding.
Yes. So the congregation was naturally reeling in the destruction of their place of worship. But that was nothing compared to what would happen next, just 6 days after the fire that burned down the beloved church. And that was the sudden murder of Pauletta Burleson.
Oh, no.
On May 18th, 2010, at about 10:15 p.m., Tracy called 911 to report his wife was dead. Pauletta had been sitting in the garage when someone had come behind her and shot her once in the back of the head, execution style. So officers respond to the scene, and there were immediately a couple of things that made the officers feel uneasy towards Tracy. First is that as they were driving up on the scene, Tracy was on the side of the road kind of waving them down. When they pulled up and got out of their vehicles, Tracy then ran to Pauletta's body and threw himself on top of it. They said it was weird. It didn't seem like the actions of a grief-stricken man. It seemed like he was almost trying to contaminate evidence or explain why he had her blood on him by making this big demonstration of sort of placing himself on top of the body. So yeah. They said that was kind of odd. Well, the officers began questioning Tracy, who told them that he'd been talking to Pauletta outside a little earlier, but had left to go to the convenience store to buy a bag of corn chips and a baby Ruth. He said that when he returned, only minutes later, he had discovered Pauletta was dead. Now, I am the queen of snacks. You know this about me, Shay. And those are some bottom-tier level snacks.
Well, if you're going to go corn chip, you need to get a dip, not a baby Ruth. And
yes.
If you're going to go candy bar...
Baby Ruth? Like, step up your snack game, dude.
That's just some nougat with some peanuts on it, right?
Who eats baby Ruths?
Isn't that the one that looks like a poopy?
Yeah.
Okay.
For sure. So, like, already you're suspicious just because the snack game is all wrong, right?
I guess so.
Well, as Tracy is telling this to the police, they're looking in his car with a flashlight because his car's right there sitting in the driveway.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, okay, great. Where are the chips and the candy bar? Because they weren't in the car. There's no trace of them. Well, Tracy tells them, well, I ate them both on the way home and threw the wrappers out the window. Now, I don't know exactly how far from the home the store was supposed to be, but most people's local convenience store is, what, maybe 5 minutes away?
Yeah, just around the corner.
So he would have had to slam down that bag of corn chips and that entire baby Ruth before being able to throw the wrappers out the window and then come home to find his wife dead. So a little suspicious, right?
It is a little suspicious. I have slammed down a snack from our convenience store on the way home because I was hangry.
An entire bag of chips and a candy bar?
That's a lot.
It seems pretty extreme. Well, there were other things at the scene that also didn't align with Tracy's story. First off, the spent shell from the gunshot was sitting right next to the front tire of the car, about maybe an inch away from the tire. Investigators reasoned that if Tracy had pulled up after the murder, he would have likely run over the shell casing, but had not. There was no damage to the actual shell casing. So their line of reasoning with that is that that car was sitting there when that shot rang out.
Do you know where the shell casing was? It in front of the tire or behind it where he would have run over it?
It was off to the side. So it was basically sitting right next to the tire. And I agree with you. It's not a terribly strong argument to me, but it is something to question. To me, you could also say, okay, well, he drove up and just happened to have missed that shell casing. It's not something to me that is very strong. But the real issue was that Pauletta's blood was spattered on the front grille of Tracy's car. It was also found on his car keys, which were found still inside the car.
Okay, that's an issue.
That's an issue.
That's a big problem. That's the biggest problem besides corn chips and a weird bullet casing. That's my number one alarm bell.
Absolutely. But Tracy didn't have any gunshot residue on his hands. So the officers began to go around and speak to neighbors to get witness statements. And they found that neighbors had heard arguing coming from the Burleson residence starting around 10 o'clock that night. The argument had continued out to the front driveway and garage area of the home. At one point, they reported hearing the words, "You're always trying to control me." And then moments later, at 10:15, they heard the sound of a single gunshot. But they said that that wasn't the only argument that had taken place at the Burleson residence that day. Neighbors reported another argument between Tracy, Pauletta, and an unknown woman at the Burleson house earlier on the morning of the shooting. When police asked Tracy who this woman was, he told them that she was his son William's friend, Tyon Palmer.
I've got a suspicion that it's one of these affairs. Just saying, I've seen enough Montel Williams and Jerry Springer. I feel like a love triangle is going to be a part of this heated argument.
We'll see. So investigators go to Tyon to figure out if she had any connection to Pauletta's murder. Tyon was a 32-year-old woman who lived with her three children and was going through a divorce. She told investigators that she had met William through a mutual friend a couple years earlier and that she had felt sorry for him. She knew that his life at home was rough. She knew that he wasn't really taking care of his health. And so she had allowed William to move in with her to live, which he had been doing for the last year or two. She was a nurse, and she said she thought she could help care for him, take him to his doctor's appointments, make sure he was taking his medicine, drive him to school, which he was going to nursing school at the time, so they kind of also had that in common. In fact, William had been in the hospital for an entire month recently, and Tyon was by his side the entire time. Tyon told them that she didn't really know Tracy, she was not the woman seen by witnesses arguing with Pauletta on the day of her death, and that she certainly had no knowledge of Pauletta's murder. And the investigators believed her. They left thinking, there's nothing here, this is a dead lead. Meanwhile, they continue putting the pressure on Tracy, especially after they contacted that little convenience store he claimed to have gone to during Pauletta's murder.
Uh-oh.
And they told them that they had closed at 10 o'clock p.m. that night, before Tracy would have arrived.
Ooh.
Of course, Tracy then changed his story, saying that he had gone there, saw it was closed, and then came back home.
So why the corn chips and Baby Ruth?
Well, he said that he felt like he had to lie and make up this alibi in order to explain why he was not there during Pauletta's murder.
Huh.
So he's like, yeah, I was lying, but I mean, I really wasn't there.
Fishy, fishy.
Very fishy. But after receiving a tip from a friend of the family, investigators quickly turned their attention to William. The tipster said that William had admitted to her that he had shot Pauletta. So police arrest him, and it really didn't take long for William to not only tell them the entire seedy story that ended in Pauletta's death, but to admit that he was the one to pull the trigger.
Wow.
So William was very open to investigators about his hatred of Pauletta. He said that Pauletta had physically and verbally abused him his whole life and had constantly ridiculed him for his sickle cell anemia. He said his father was also abusive to him, but that Pauletta was much worse and always instigated violence within the household. But he said the murder really wasn't about that. He said that he had killed Pauletta because he had been asked to kill her by his father, Tracy, and the woman Tracy had been currently having an affair with, Tyon Palmer.
Whoa, that is crazy.
Yeah, you guessed right. You see, sometime after William had moved in with Tyon, he had taken her to the church where she had met Tracy. Tracy had taken a liking to Tyon and had written her a love letter, telling her she was pretty and he wanted to date her and that he'd prayed to God about her, etc., etc.
This guy.
William said that he hadn't really wanted to give Tyon the letter because he knew his father was a womanizer who didn't treat people very well, especially the woman in his life. And he considered Tyon a very close friend.
Yeah.
But he did anyway. And in December of 2009, after the delivery of this letter, Tracy and Tyon started secretly dating and began a whirlwind affair. And I mean whirlwind because it was only a few months before the affair became serious and Tracy asked Tyon to marry him.
What?
They even took family photos with Tyon's children and William and announced their engagement to Tyon's family on Mother's Day. And yes, this was all happening while Tracy was still married to and living with Pauletta.
That's a bold move, Cotton. Let's see if that pans out, which we know it doesn't.
Exactly. So just to underline the timeline here, by Mother's Day, May 9th, Tracy and Tyon were already going around telling people they were engaged. Then on May 12th, Tracy's church suddenly burns down. And then on May 18th, Pauletta is murdered.
Man, on Mother's Day even.
Yeah.
God, this is a whole big problem. This is a very complex, deep relationship
triangle. Me, it goes deeper.
What? Mm-hmm. Okay, strap in, people.
So during his questioning, William claimed that actually Tracy had been telling William to kill Pauletta for years, long before he had even met Tyon. His father knew he'd be screwed financially if Pauletta divorced him, and if news of his many affairs came to light, he'd be fired from his job. And there was another little incentive. Can you guess what that was?
Insurance money.
Yes! A $100,000 life insurance policy. William said that Tracy told him he would give him $2,000 of that life insurance money if he killed Pauletta.
$2,000 to kill your own mom.
Well, stepmother. But well, yes, yeah. Point is very valid. William said Tracy would get physical and abusive with him, trying to intimidate him into the murder. The pressure got worse when Tyon came into the picture because she backed Tracy on the idea and also started pressuring William into the murder so she and Tracy could be together. Tyon, William claimed, had even helped him get the murder weapon.
Not a good friend.
Very, very bad friend, at least according to William's story.
Sure.
Now, according to William, the night of the murder went like this. Tracy and Pauletta had started fighting. Tracy called William and told him, "Now's the time. Come kill her." William went to his parents' house with a gun and walked inside, past where Pauletta and Tracy were arguing in the front of the garage. Tracy came inside and confirmed that William had the gun and told him that he would distract Pauletta so William could shoot her. Tracy then went back outside to where Pauletta was sitting and stood between her and his car. Remember that blood spatter found on the front of the car. Tracy then instigated another round of the argument, and William walked behind his stepmother and shot her in the back of the head.
Holy crap. That is... Whew.
It's cold, man. Tracy told him to leave so he could call the police, and also made sure to instruct William to make sure and get rid of the gun. So William walked about a block away and called Tyon to pick him up. William told Tyon that he had just killed Pauletta, so they stopped at Tyon's cousin's house so he could shower, get cleaned up, destroy evidence, all of that fun stuff. Then Tyon drove them to an embankment and he threw the gun into a bayou. So some of those famous Houston bayous. We don't have any bayous up here to throw your murder weapons in, but...
Man, we have a lot of flooding recently, so they look like bayous.
It does. So from William's description, detectives were able to locate and collect this gun because when he threw it over, he thought he had tossed it directly into the body of water, but it actually kind of like landed on the side. It didn't actually go in the water. So they were able to collect it just fine, apparently.
That is a huge, crucial mistake. If you're going to commit a murder like that, you're not going to make sure it actually lands in the bayou itself?
Yeah. Well, this wasn't exactly the most planned out thing, if you haven't noticed. But here's the weirdest part of the story. William also admitted in his interview that starting just 2 days after the murder, Tyon and him had started sleeping together.
Oh, wait, what?
So just after Pauletta is dead, both father and son are having sex with the same woman.
Man, I don't like any of this. I don't like it at all.
Now, here's the thing. William never admits to having feelings for Tyon or being in love with her or any of that. But another really weird piece of the puzzle is that he had gotten Tyon's lips tattooed on his neck. That's a really weird thing to do for a woman who you're claiming is just your friend and your sexual relationship with her is very recent.
Yeah.
But you have her lips tattooed on your neck? Like, that's...
So she, like, took a kiss imprint, and then he took that to a tattoo artist and said, I want this on my neck.
That's what it seems like.
Oh, boy.
Well, this love triangle thing is going to come back at trial, I promise. So we will get into the nitty-gritty of all of that. So investigators aren't really surprised by William's story. They'd been looking at Tracy all along anyway, but they were surprised about Tyon's involvement. After all, they had talked to her. And they had left completely believing her story that she didn't even know Tracy. So they're kind of blown away that she was able to lie to them so easily.
It's a little scary.
Yeah. So, of course, William, Tracy, and Tyon are all arrested for the murder of Pauletta Burleson. Tracy and Tyon were arrested together at Tyon's house. Turns out that about a week after the murder, and after Tyon and William had started having sex, Tracy had moved in with Tyon. They were sleeping in the same bed and wearing matching pajamas at the time of their arrest.
That's a bad look. That's really bad optics for you if you're claiming innocence in all this.
Yeah.
This is a train wreck. It really is. And you can't look away.
It's very bizarre. It's very weird, very uncomfortable, the whole thing. Upon his arrest, Tracy admitted to the affair with Tyon, but denied any involvement in Pauletta's murder. He said that their relationship was rocky, but that he still loved Pauletta regardless of their issues and would never have wanted to see her hurt. He also claimed that he had not even known about the life insurance policy. This was a little fishy because by the time of his arrest, investigators knew that shortly after the murder, Tracy had called to check on that policy and in fact had discovered that he was the beneficiary of a $30,000 policy, not the $100,000 policy that William said he had been expecting. And in fact, William was like, yeah, we had a whole conversation about how he was only going to be getting a third of the money he thought he was going to when he was not happy. But then according to Tracy, he's like, oh, I didn't know anything about it.
Yeah, of course.
Tracy continued to maintain that he made that trip to the convenience store during the fateful moments that Pauletta was shot. When asked what he would want to say to his congregation, he answered, quote, I want them to know that I love being the pastor at the church and I'm so sorry for the adultery. But I want them to know I did not kill my wife. Tyon, meanwhile, admitted to the affair with Tracy, but said that she hadn't actually been aware that Tracy and Pauletta were still married. In fact, she claimed Tracy explicitly told her that they were in the process of getting a divorce. She also admitted to helping William cover up the murder and get rid of the murder weapon that night, but she was adamant that she did not ask William to kill Pauletta and had no previous knowledge of any plans to kill her. So basically, she says, William called her, she came to pick him up, and then sometime later that night, he was like, oh, I killed Pauletta. And that was the first time she had ever heard about it. That's her story.
But he also said that you need to drive me to a bayou so I can throw this gun in it. And she was like, okay.
Yes. And she says that the only reason why she helped him that night is because she felt sorry for him. She didn't know what else to do. She's claiming at this point that she almost has this motherly kind of relationship with William. Even though William was about 19 and she was 32, that's not a mother-son age difference.
Yeah, I mean...
So that's a little weird, but that's kind of... That's the road that she's trying to take in when she's describing all of this.
Yeah, I get, you know, how they became friends and that she was a nurse and he had the sickle cell anemia and, you know, she was compassionate and empathetic to his condition. But like you're saying, that those are two different things. And like a motherly relationship with him and like, you know, just they're romantically engaged. That's another thing. So if you're claiming you had a motherly relationship with this guy who has your lips tattooed on his neck.
Yeah, then it almost becomes
then it's
grosser,
weird.
Right? Yeah. Well, here's the thing that Tyon has to say about that sexual relationship with William. She would later say that after Pauletta's death, William became very violent, and he was prone to these sudden bursts of anger to the point that she was afraid of him. Tyon admitted to having sex with William 2 days after the murder. However, what she describes in her interview on the TV show Facing Evil is rape. And it's very clearly a description of rape. She basically says that he forced her and that she did not want to have sex with him. She does not actually use the word rape itself, but that is very much what she's describing. She said this only happened once, and that was the extent of any sexual contact that they had together.
Do we know if that's true?
We don't know what is true. These parts of the story are very he said, she said.
Okay. But at this point, William is saying that they had a relationship, you know, and he also has this tattoo. And then Tyon is saying, no, I basically got raped. Gotcha.
Yeah. Investigators also ask her about some suspicious texts between herself and a coworker where Tyon is asking to buy a gun shortly before the murder. Now, it certainly appeared to investigators that this supported William's claim that Tyon had helped secure the gun he would use on Pauletta, and that she was trying to make an illegal purchase, basically. She wanted to avoid a paper trail.
Yep.
Right? Of course, she then told them that, well, she was just simply looking for a gun to protect her family after some burglaries in her neighborhood.
Nope. That's all I have to say. Not buying it. And then it magically ends up being used in a murder.
No biggie.
Yeah, okay, you want to buy a gun to protect yourself for home security. I'm cool with that. Go take a class, learn how to use it, register that gun when you buy it, and it is your gun so that things like this don't happen.
Yes. And to be clear, the gun that was actually used in the murder, I don't have any information about where that came from. I think Williams still claimed that Tyon had helped him secure it, but we have no evidence of that. Uh-huh. And Tyon, of course, is not going to admit that herself.
Sure.
But we do have these text messages proving that she was asking around for a gun
illegally.
Sometime before Pauletta's murder. Yes, illegally. Yeah. So it's all very hinky-jinky.
Hinky-jinky. Again, bad optics if you're trying to defend yourself.
Oh, absolutely. So about a year goes by, and that's when these trials begin. And we got to spend some time on them because they are wacky. Like, fit for an episode of Law & Order with the crazy courtroom shenanigans wacky. So first up, let's talk about William. He was actually offered a plea deal in return for his testimony against Tracy and Tyon. And the plea deal took the capital charge off of the table.
Okay.
William ended up being sentenced to 20 years in prison for murder. His time will be served in 2030, and he will be eligible parole in 2020.
So coming up pretty quick.
Coming up pretty soon, that's right. So let's talk about Tracy's trial. It began in September of 2011. According to the Houston Chronicle, Tracy was actually offered his own plea deal, a 40-year sentence in exchange for pleading guilty. However, Tracy decided to reject the deal and take his case to trial because he thought he could be acquitted.
Those are some high hopes, buddy.
It sure is. Let's see how that works out for him. Tracy's defense centered on the idea that he had no hand in his wife's murder and that William was framing him to get revenge because he was angry that Tracy was dating Tyon.
I'm beginning to see the wacky part that you were describing earlier. Okay.
Oh, we haven't even gotten to that part, honey.
Oh, good Lord.
When William took the stand, he freely admitted his feelings towards his stepmother. When asked by the prosecutor if it would be fair to say he didn't like Pauletta, William replied, I still hate her.
Whoa.
Yeah. And he actually also has no quandaries, no problems admitting that he was the one to kill her. So he's very upfront, very open about all of this. He described the verbal and physical abuse he claimed to have endured from both Pauletta and Tracy, and the fact that Tracy had been hassling him for months, even years, to kill Pauletta. And that ultimately, he had been promised life insurance money when the job was done, as well as a car and a place to live in exchange for the murder. But then, William oversteps things a little. While on the stand, he is asked to go through the events of the day of the murder. He begins by stating that Tracy had been explaining to Tyon that he needed more time to take care of Pauletta because, quote, him and Pauletta had just set the church on fire and he wanted to play that off. Well, that was a big no-no. Because, you see, the defense had filed a motion in limine regarding the alleged arson of the church. So any reference to Tracy's involvement was supposed to be excluded because it was prejudicial. And let me be clear that the arson of the church has never been prosecuted. No charges have ever. It's just a very big question mark. And we have a lot of hints that perhaps Tracy was involved, but we don't have any evidence. And then now we have William on the stand blurting this out, even though there's a motion specifically prohibiting the mention of this evidence.
Wow. Okay. That's crazy. Somebody needs to pay for burning that church down, though.
Well, the defense team requested a motion for a mistrial.
Because of the outburst?
Because of the outburst, and because it was specifically in violation of the motion in limine to suppress that information. However, the judge denied the motion, resolving only to instruct the jury to disregard William's statements. Tracy did not end up testifying in his own defense. With William's fiery testimony and the forensic evidence found at the scene, Tracy was convicted of murder and was sentenced to life in prison without parole.
Should have taken that plea.
Tooken?
Yep, I'm going to go with tooken because I'm a Texan. Should have taken that plea.
So obviously he has been appealing this sentence. And one of the things that he has really tried to harp on in his appeal is that this should have been a mistrial because of William's statements of the arson. So the appeals documents are out there if you want to read them. It's not really interesting, but yeah. There you go. They have been looked at and, oh, okay, no, it's fine that it went on. It didn't have to be a mistrial. Everything's cool. So now we get to the cuckoo bananas trial of Tyon.
I like that term, cuckoo bananas trial. So is this where we're actually going to find out some answers, or is this just going to be more confusion?
This is just more insanity, Shay. Okay. There's right. No answers in this case. So this is one thing that I find so fascinating and so funny about court cases. And that's the ways that a defense team crafts your image at trial. So you become this innocent, believable victim instead of a perpetrator of a horrible crime, mm-hmm. right? And it's all of this really hilarious propaganda. So you saw that in the Menendez brothers with their like pastel sweaters, and their defense attorney would always refer to them as boys, even though they were grown men and all of that. Yeah. Or Jodi Arias, how she showed up with no makeup and looking like a school marm.
Yeah.
Well, that's very much what happens in Tyon's court case. Which, hey, I'm not criticizing her because it's smart. It's smart to establish yourself as if you are a very innocent person. You want to have that propaganda working for you, and why not? So she wore a very matronly suit every day to trial. She tied her hair back in this little secretarial bun. She wears no makeup. She wears glasses the whole time, which I'd like to discuss why glasses are like the I'm an innocent victim look for every defendant in every trial you've ever heard of. And it's interesting in this case because I've seen a lot of pictures of her. I've seen a lot of interviews, a lot of videos. I have not seen her wear a pair of glasses anywhere else except for in her murder trial.
Do you think they were fake glasses?
I don't know. It's an interesting look, like I said, mm-hmm. it's very interesting strategy to try to influence the jury, which is what it's all about.
Hey, good news for everyone who actually does wear glasses, because that means we look innocent.
That's right. Do I look innocent right now?
Mm-hmm. You always look innocent.
Oh. Well, Tyon also walks into court with a ring on her finger and her new husband supporting her in the courtroom.
Both William and... Oh, so it's not William or Tracy.
No.
Oh, wow. Okay, this is another person.
I was about to say, who are you? Okay. Who else are you going to guess?
I was thinking we had like a prison marriage going on.
No, Tyon had gotten married while out on bond before her trial to just, I don't know, some other man.
Some dude.
Yep. And I'll tell you why that's especially interesting to me in a second. But just for right now, let's solidify the fact that pretty much nobody knew she had gotten married. So this was a surprise to pretty much everyone in the courtroom. So Tyon's defense strategy was pretty similar to Tracy's. They wanted to show that Tyon had no knowledge about the murder, that she had only helped William out of pity, which then turned to fear as he became violent. They also went with the defense of, hey, William's only saying all this and lying because he's trying to take revenge on Tyon because he's in love with her and he was angry that she was dating his father. So in a nutshell, that's the defense. The prosecution was trying to prove that Tyon helped get the murder weapon, that she wanted Pauletta dead just as much as Tracy. She wanted to take her throne as the First Lady of the Church, and that she used William's feelings for her and even sex to manipulate him into murder. Well, William gets on the witness stand. And you'd think that since he almost screwed the pooch on Tracy's trial that he would be a bit more rational and calm during Tyon's trial, and you would be horribly incorrect. He starts screaming and cussing and lashing out on the witness stand, both at Tyon as she's sitting at the defense table and at her attorney, Anthony, also as he's questioning him.
You're right. This is banana. What'd you call it? Wacky bananas?
Cuckoo bananas. At one point, also asked that Fuller be directed to stop yelling at his client, to which William said, "Man, I'm directing at you." Also then said, "Judge, I need a break. I've lost my train of thought." To which William responded, "You always get lost in a lie."
Ooh, bird.
Bird, William. Then William starts screaming and yelling at a man sitting in the courtroom. He said, quote, "I see you huffing and puffing back there just because you don't want to hear what I'm saying. You want to fight?" Keep in mind, this is all happening as William is testifying in a court of law in a capital murder case.
So he sees a guy in the back of the room not agreeing with what he's saying, kind of.
And he's trying to fight him.
And he's trying to challenge him to a battle in the courtroom?
Yes. Now, the man he was screaming at was never identified anywhere, but I think that it's a good chance that it was actually Tyon's new husband.
Mm.
So that's my understanding of the situation, but I don't have any proof of that. Well, William got so irate that he had to be dragged from the courtroom in a chokehold by a bailiff, all the while screaming at Tyon, calling her a liar and a bitch.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, you know, we never mentioned bailiffs in any of these stories, but sounds like they have to deal with some really wacky bananas situations from time to time, and it seems like a rough job.
I agree. The judge ended up ordering a mistrial due to William's outburst.
Learn your lesson, man.
However, Tyon's attorney shortly thereafter withdrew his request for a mistrial, and the trial proceeded as normal. Why, you may ask, would a defense attorney withdraw a request for a mistrial that was already granted? After all, a mistrial is usually great for a defense team because it means you get extra time to craft your defense. You have some inkling of what angles the prosecution is going for already. And you know that your client is going to be happy about putting off the trial a little bit longer. And as we've seen in the previous case, usually a defense attorney jumps at the chance for a mistrial.
Yeah. My only guess is they think they can win this thing. And they're like, you know what? No, we want to keep going. That's my only guess. Or they have some other motion that's going to be crazy.
Well, yeah, basically. Because according to the Houston Chronicle, this may have been a strategic move. William's crazy tirade and multiple aggressive outbursts portrayed him as an angry, emotional hothead. This strategy kind of makes sense because apparently the judge also had to instruct Osso several times to stop baiting the witness. So maybe there's something there that this was a decision to try to goad him a little to see if he'd lash out. If it was, it certainly went well. Either way, they realized William's antics in the courtroom actually helped Tyon's case.
That's what we always talk about in these cases, where the trial is a whole nother beast.
It really is.
There's so much more depth and so much more things going on that most people don't realize during a trial from the defense and the prosecution. Like, the prosecution should have probably expected them to goad William into this kind of a response and probably should have prepared him better.
Well, probably should have expected that William was probably not the best witness as far as just, you know, being reserved and answering the questions and not getting angry when he was being questioned. Exactly. Well, according to ABC 13 Eyewitness News, legal analyst Joel Andrefy said, quote, "There's a certain amount of theatrics that are okay, but when a witness crosses the line and is totally out of control, like what happened here, it is not a good thing. Then you start questioning the witness's credibility." So that's one very, very big issue. And in the episode of Snapped, Anthony Osso, the attorney for Tyon, said of William's behavior, quote, "I couldn't have scripted it better."
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. So it really worked out for Tyon very, very well.
That's why you need those good defense attorneys, man.
Yeah. Now, this time, Tyon opted to take the stand in her own defense. Now, one of the things her defense team was really trying to argue in trial was that Tyon and Tracy's relationship really wasn't that serious. Obviously, this helps their side of the story because if Tyon wasn't really that into Tracy, why would she ever be involved in a murder to be with him? doesn't make sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as an aside here, again, talking about the staging and the propaganda that can influence a jury, I think that Taeyeon showing up married to another man might have been a part of that. Like, hey, I wasn't even serious about getting married to Tracy. Look how fast I moved on. I've already married somebody else.
Yep. And I've put all this behind me.
Uh-huh.
And I know I'm innocent.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's my opinion on the case. I don't know for sure. I don't know the woman. But I think that might have been, again, a strategic move by her defense team.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so this is basically how Taeyeon describes her relationship to Tracy during the trial. She says that he was obsessed with her. She only agreed to marry him to shut him up, but she really wasn't that serious about it, blah, blah, blah. Well, then the prosecution comes back on cross and they're like, oh, yeah, you weren't that serious with Tracy? Hmm? Is that right? Hmm? Well, why is it that while you and Tracy were on bond right after the murder, you two went and got a marriage license? And why do we have these photos of you trying on wedding gowns?
Whoa.
Bam! And they like throw the images up on the big screen.
See, the prosecution was ready for that one. They were like, we see how this is going.
Yeah, which I mean, the defense obviously should have known they had that stuff. So it's very weird. Of course, she was like, oh, well, you know, I was just trying to please Tracy, but I still wasn't serious about the whole thing. And, blah, blah, blah.
It's such another like Jerry Springer reveal.
I know. I know. I love it. Very dramatic. Taeyeon was also found guilty of murder, not capital murder, and tampering with evidence. But her sentence may or may not be surprising to some. Now, we know that a murder sentence can range from 5 to 99 years, a very, very big span of time. So how long do you think Taeyeon received?
From everything you just told me, maybe 7 to 10 years, maybe somewhere in that window.
Oh, very, very good. She was sentenced to 7 years in prison and 10 years probation, which, hey, maybe that's fair. I don't know. I think it depends on whether or not you believe her that she was just a pawn in all of this, or if you believe William that she was directly involved and helped to plan the murder. I mean, clearly either William is lying or she is, and there's really not anything else to tell us what the truth is there.
Yeah, unless you have something definitive and a smoking gun, that's the only way you could give her like 25 to 50 or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And this is the thing about Taeyeon that is very confusing to me, because she does come off as sweet and innocent and totally believable. These interviews that she does, she seems like a victim in all of this. And a part of me really wanted to feel sympathetic for her. Part of me was really buying into these stories that she was telling. But then I kept going back to the fact that she straight up lied about everything to two homicide detectives, and they totally believed her.
Mm.
So I think she might be a very, very fantastic liar. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's very hard for me to believe this stuff about she wasn't really that serious about Tracy and that she didn't know that he was married. I mean, that's very hard for me to believe. Yeah. The murder stuff, I don't know. I could go either way. But some of those other things, I think, are definitely stretches of the truth.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, Taeyeon would have been eligible for parole in 2015. And regardless of whether or not she received it, she would be out by now anyway. She would have been out probably last year.
Wonder if she's still married to that guy.
I don't know. That's a very good question. Apparently, he was taking care of her children while she was in prison. So hopefully, I guess that worked out. I don't know. I mean, in a nutshell, that's the case. There, like I said, there's a lot of he said, she said. Some of that, I don't know what to believe. But William seems awfully forthcoming. But, you know, if you believe that he's this crazy psycho murderer and he was trying to take revenge on everybody in his life, you know, maybe he did make it all up. At least when it comes to Taeyeon, I believe 100% that Tracy goaded him into it and Tracy was involved.
Yeah, I agree with you. And the other thing I would say is, you know, I think you reap what you sow. And I think Tracy's verbal and physical abuse to his children has definitely a huge part in the results that he received at the end of all this.
Yeah.
So whether or not that William is, like you said, some kind of crazed psychopath who's just trying to get revenge, maybe you'd have a better kid if you didn't just beat him all the time. And
well, I mean, that's the thing, dude. He was 19 when this all happened.
Yeah.
He was abused his whole life. He was this sickly kid with sickle cell anemia who was in and out of the hospital all the time. He hated his mother because she was a horrible, cruel monster to him. His stepmother, excuse me. And then his father was also a horrible, cruel monster, but it was somebody he wanted to please.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm saying.
So much.
Yeah.
And then Tyon comes into his life and he seems to have feelings for her. And she's also asking him to do this horrible thing. And I think he just really got pushed around by, at the very least, his father, pushed around into doing something. And he's a kid and he hated her anyway.
Yeah. I mean, he did murder her.
Yes.
But what led to this is a lot of times what we're fascinated with in the show. And like, how did we get to this point? This crazy cuckoo bananas point. And I think that's the point of our show. And that's ultimately why we're fascinated by cases like this and what makes us go back and forth years after the fact that these cases have been over and done with. I still want somebody to get charged in the arson of that church.
Yeah.
Because somebody burned down my grandma's church and nobody was ever charged with that either. And that just sticks in my craw. Stop burning down churches.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, it's all these things that shouldn't be biases in a perfect world. The fact that you have your hair pinned back and you're wearing glasses shouldn't affect the jury, but it does. We know that.
Yep. The fact that you sprayed silly string on your son's grave right before your trial.
Are you referencing Darlie Rautier? I was about to say, girl, don't you even. We have not got to that case.
Yeah, yet. That one's on the docket for sure if you're a Darlie Rautier fan.
Oh, Lord. But yeah, you know, there are these things where we're like, the court system isn't supposed to be prejudicial. So it's not supposed to be biased. It's supposed to be like this system that is as logical as possible. And we know that that's not true.
Yeah.
The way that you're portrayed in trial, in front of the jury, in the media is all so crucial to what happens to you. It's that narrative that spins everything else.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Well, is that all you got for us today?
That's all I got. What, do you wanted more? I gave you everything.
You did. You went all out. You did hard work on this one.
It was a lot of work, I gotta tell you. This might have been one of the most complicated cases for me yet, which, it was frustrating. But I thought it was really a fascinating case in so many different ways. So I hope you guys all enjoyed it.
Well, as a reward, I have a little carrot at the end of the stick.
Yeah.
That's led you to the promised land.
Mm-hmm.
A cookie at the end of your meal.
A Baby Ruth at the end of your drive to the convenience
Hopefully this is better than a Baby Ruth. But yeah, we'll be right back after this with some good news. All right, good news, Aaron.
I'm ready for it.
Good, because I got some for you. This comes to us from none other than the Odessa American. Do you remember the Odessa American from one of our previous episodes?
I do not.
It was from La Kiva, the murder at La Kiva.
Mm-hmm.
The Odessa American is kind of one of the biggest publications in West Texas, and they are excited to tell everybody about this $275,000 gift from Concho Resources Incorporated, or just Concho. It's a Midland, Odessa-based independent natural gas and oil company, which people might immediately go, ooh, oil. But what Concho is doing is actually really focused on rehabilitating Texas native lands. And they have a vested interest in saving West Texas native seeds and growing them, and making this massive West Texas seed bank and a greenhouse that they're going to build at Sol Ross University. And they're going to call it the West Texas Native Seeds Research Center. So I don't know if most people will know this, but West Texas is in what we call an oil boom right now. There's tons of natural gas and generic oil wells popping up all over the place in West Texas. One of the problems is when these people go into these areas, it's kind of a destructive process to go in and build these oil platforms and roads and all this stuff. Well, their hope is for the West Texas Native Seed Research Center at Sol Ross that they will be able to have this $200 million research center to produce a bulk quantity of native seeds to go in and rehabilitate the land and do all sorts of rangeland restoration in West Texas
to help with everything after it's all said and done. So they have three main goals with this project. And the first is to collect, evaluate, and figure out how they're going to release these seed sources. And then second is they're going to develop and disseminate a restoration and reclamation strategy for oil and gas companies across West Texas. And so they're going to work with one of the environmental boards in Texas to help upgrade our reclamation processes, which is really cool. Like, that's awesome. And that's some of the work that I do at my day job with rangeland restoration, rangeland habitats. So I have a real passion for this kind of work, because a lot of times this doesn't happen and you end up with what we call dead zones after these companies move on and pick up and leave. So these projects are going to be, like I said, mainly used with oil and gas projects and highway right-of-way restorations, energy transmission right-of-ways, oil and gas construction zones, and all sorts of other horticultural and rangeland restoration projects with just independent farmers and ranchers. So, yeah, it's a really cool thing, especially for a company like this to step up and back this project where they don't have to. There's been a huge outcry for people to study Texas native species of rangeland plants for a long time, specifically for this purpose, because we still haven't recovered from the Dust Bowl in West Texas. And I think this is really cool. They've collected 900 different species of plants, but they've already produced several species that they have quite a collection of. They have some silver bloomstem and whiplash pappus grass that they're already putting out to different companies.
Well, that sounds really cool. I would imagine as well that might help reconstruction efforts maybe after natural disasters too. Like we've seen in the past, well, we have a whole lot of flooding going on across Texas. We've had issues with forest fires destroying large parts of Texas, of course not like other areas of the country, but it has been an issue in the past. So
but
I
years
would imagine
ago, years ago it was prairie fires though, and this would be perfect for that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it also reminds me of that huge bunker they have somewhere in like Antarctica or something that houses all of the world's seeds. Mm-hmm. It's like a huge seed bank that they've collected, especially for reconstruction efforts after the impending apocalypse, which is just around the corner.
Yeah. Yeah. So we kind of have our own Texas seed bunker now at Sol Ross University.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah. I think it's cool. A lot of people will probably listen to this and be like, "Ooh, seeds, stupid." But it's really important, you know, as we continue to screw up the environment and change things.
Yeah.
It's good to have a backup plan. You know?
Well, it's also good that it's focused on native Texas plants and yeah. Because, you know, obviously there's lots of issues environmentally with encroaching plants and stuff that are not native.
Invasive species.
Yeah, that actually screw up the environment.
Exactly.
So that's pretty neat to see. Well, keep an eye on that and see what kind of research they can get into and what they can do.
Get seedy.
Getting seedy.
Okay, guys, we're back from the good news section, and that means that up next, we're going to be doing some recommendations for podcasts that you should be checking out and listening to with your ear holes. Isn't that right, Aaron?
Not other holes.
That would be weird, but you know what? We just thought of it, so that means that it's a thing and that it exists somewhere. Anyways, the podcast that we're going to talk to you about today is one of our good podcasting buddies, and I'm sorry we haven't gotten around to promoting your show yet, but here it is. This is what we're doing. It's Unresolved. This show is really cool. It's hosted by Michael, and Michael has another show that we might promote in the future. But for now, we're going to talk about Unresolved. Unresolved is really cool. It is an investigative podcast that aims to tell stories which have no ending. So if you're one of those people that needs resolution, you can probably tell by the title, it's Unresolved. So, but what I like about his show is he takes stories that don't have an ending and need further investigation and really digs into them. Such as one of his big hot episodes was the Zodiac Killer. And he does like a really good series on the Zodiac Killer
The one that I just listened to that was really good was about these Kenyan cults that happened back in 2010. It's based on this Nairobi serial killer who is Kenya's most prolific serial killer, Philip Onyacha. He did some really, really awful stuff with blood drinking and human sacrifice, and there's some organized cult stuff going on. It's terrifying. It's the perfect thing to listen to during Halloween, I feel. I was texting Aaron today about it, and I was just like, this is terrifying.
Yeah, no, I'm going to have to listen to that next because it sounds really interesting. Because it's not only serial killers, which who's not interested in that topic, but a serial killer from another culture is something even more unique. And it's got that added layer of what the hell is going on here.
I know. Kenyan blood cults is just the whole topic that I was immediately drawn to. And I was like, I need to find out about that.
Yeah. But yeah, his is a great show. And like you were saying, there's so many topics that he talks about on his show that a lot of people don't cover because they are unresolved. And we all usually, we want that closure. We want that end to our narrative. And so these are a lot of stories that are so fascinating and need to be heard, but you don't hear about them that often. And that's what I really like about a show. Really interesting stuff. So you guys should all go and listen and subscribe and all of that good stuff that you do right now.
Yeah. And let's hear from Michael himself.
My name is Michael Whelan, and I am the host of a podcast called Unresolved. In 2015, before the true crime podcasting wave really kicked off, I wanted to start a show that focused on not only the gory details, but the human stories at the center of every mystery. Because for every unsolved murder or baffling experience, there are multiple lives left without an answer. Since I started the podcast, I have tried to focus on unfinished stories, both big and small, to try and figure out why and how some of us are left without any resolution. I'm interested in learning about these unknown aspects of life, and I hope that you are too. Check out my podcast, Unresolved, on your podcast app of choice, or just stop by the show's website, unresolved.me, to learn more.
Hey guys, welcome to the after show. This episode, like all episodes this month, is brought to you by our Texas Ranger, our very own Lisa L. She's great. She's fantastic. Best person I've ever met. Yeah. And I've never met her.
Honorary producer of the show. She stepped up to the plate and she's already organized a Dallas Stars meetup, which we're super excited about because we're going to bring Mike all the way from Canada down here to Dallas, Texas. From Dark Poutine, and we're going to have an ACNC Dark Poutine crossover meetup with hockey from America and Canada, because the Dallas Stars are playing the Oilers. It's going to be amazing. Go find those links on our social media and get your tickets.
Yeah, I've heard, now don't quote me on this, but I've heard that Mike will be stuffing his pockets full of poutine, especially for the game, to bring down here, and we're all going to eat poutine at the game together.
Pocket poutine.
It's going to be delicious. Guys, get your Halloween stories into us, please. If you could, email them at allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. That would be great because we're doing a cool Patreon episode with some listener stories. We also have a few of our podcast friends participating, so we'll have some creepy stories from them. It'll be great.
Yeah.
And we're also going to be doing a regular Halloween episode as well with some creepy and true Texas cases.
That's right.
And that'll be dropping just before Halloween. So if you're wondering if we're doing that, of course we are, because Halloween's the best holiday there is.
Yeah. And we're super excited to do it.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can find us on Twitter at ACNC Podcast. You can find us on Instagram at All Crime No Cattle. And you can find us on Facebook. We have a Facebook page. Have at it.
We were recently in an article on Vulture. You can find us there, along with our close friends, Last Podcast on the Left. Best buddies we are.
Are we?
Yeah.
Is this one of those things, like the magical thinking they're always talking about? Yeah. If we say chaos enough, magic. It'll come true?
Yeah, chaos magic.
How crazy would it be to hang out with the three of them? It would be glorious.
I say it every day before I go to bed.
Do you? I'm going to have to start doing that too.
Okay.
Okay, well, enough of this madness. Let's get on to our 5-star reviews. We're going to be doing Facebook first. We're still slowly trying to catch up to that cutoff point that we have, so we've still got quite a bit to go, but we're trying our best. So first up, we have Andrea Ball, who says, one of my favorite podcasts, conversational, detailed, witty, and engaging. I love that. CDWE. Sandra Ray says, I've only listened to 2 episodes, but I love the show. Shay and Aaron are great hosts. Smiley face. Thank you.
Well, one of us is a good host, and it's me.
You guys are listening to the slow breakdown of our marriage. Speaking of Michael from Unresolved, he also recommends All Crime, No Cattle on our Facebook page, and it says,
Michael,
great storytelling, and the hosts do a wonderful job of presenting the stories. What a nice guy.
It's a review that's as brilliant as his own show.
I agree. Both of his shows.
Yeah, both. His other show is Hoax, by the way.
Yeah.
If you were wondering.
Bruce Shepard says, I just started listening and I am just 6 episodes in. I started on episode 1 and will continue until I have caught up. I think it was Mike from the Dark Poutine podcast. Wow, this is getting weird.
This is a Dark Poutine episode all of a sudden.
Everything is self-referential. So he recommended your podcast. Thoroughly enjoying it. Thanks and keep up the good work. Texas is far away from Nova Scotia, but a good yarn about true crime is a good yarn no matter the geography. I like that.
Now, is Nova Scotia what they referred to as a Newfie? Or is that, no, that's Newfoundland, right?
Oh, well, yeah, that's. Yeah.
See, we're so dumb about Canada and its provinces.
But we can sing the Canada national anthem about.
Can we?
Oh, Canada.
Your fields are snowy and white.
That's not right.
No,
true patriots.
I like it. Can I tell you what my favorite part about when a French Canadian team comes to Dallas and we go to the Dallas Stars game, our wonderful person who sings the national anthem, she does it in French, and I really enjoy it. I really enjoy when she sings the Canadian national anthem in French.
Does she really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's great.
Vive la France.
Vive la France. Le Québécois, le French Canadien.
Nope, we're not allowed to say any kind of Canadian accents anymore.
I know, we upset people
got mad at us.
We upset a lot of Canadians last episode.
Which I don't understand why. It was a compliment.
We were trying to say that you guys are so much better than us. That's what we were trying to say. And our postal workers that worked on a train were dumb. You guys are nice and just didn't know what was going on and are great people. That's what we were trying to say.
Joy Jordan says, not only do I enjoy this podcast, I also really like the banter between these two. Perfect chemistry. I'm new to podcast, but y'all were my first. Wow, first podcast.
Oh.
That's exciting, Joy. There is a lot to enjoy out there.
Oh,
I apologize, Joy.
What's happened at this point?
Megan Larson says, I'm a pretty recent transplant to Texas, 4 years from New Mexico, and this podcast is the best introduction to my new home that I found. Ooh. I really appreciate that they are careful to mention the sources used for their stories. It's a classy move. Oh, classy. That's the first time we've ever been called classy in our lives.
Thank you.
I appreciate their careful research and their engaging storytelling style. Very nice, Megan. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and move on to iTunes, Seamus?
Sounds good to me. We're going to start off with Brianna for sure. Listening from Maine, she says, I love crime podcasts, but it's so hard to find people with good tone and someone to keep my ADHD mind interested. And you guys do it. Can't stop binge listening. Side note, my sister-in-law lives in Texas, and I told her to listen and probably start on thinking of carrying a taser going forward.
Uh-oh.
Hey, you know what? That's preventative measures. And you should always be safe wherever you go.
Yep.
Next up is Amsray, and they say, very entertaining. I'm only a couple of episodes in and love it so far. Being as I live in North Texas, I enjoy learning about crimes in the area and the rest of the state.
Yeah, I like that. I like that people feel like they actually come away learning something about different parts of Texas. That's pretty cool.
That was one of our missions when we started the show. Emorg88 says, new favorite. Just found y'all, and I'm on a full-blown binge fest. Great job, and I can't wait to hear more.
Thank you. Well, we've got more for you.
Oh, do we ever. We've got a whole list. Got an Excel sheet that we've been building. Emilian SD, that's what I'm going to go with. Emilian SD says, great podcast. Been binge listening for a week now, and I'm really loving this podcast. Aaron and Shay have great banter, and I love the palate cleanser at the end. The music is also fabulous, and I adore the Canine Posse. Keep it up. They are asleep.
They are tuckered out.
As always, God, that's all they do is sleep. Alyssa 17790 says, a new favorite. I'm all about true crime and listen to most of the big name true crime podcasts. Well, All Crime No Cattle is right up there with the best ones. I look forward to every episode. Keep it up, guys.
Wow, that's very nice.
Peg LMG says, bonding with my kids with true crime. Recently binge listened to y'all as I drove across country with my two daughters for their high school graduation trip. We love your banter and your voices reminded us of home. We were laughing and feeling each other's faces on the Bones episode, and we had to pause the podcast to listen to Pantera for a little bit.
Yeah, I love it.
Nothing brings a family together like true crime and the Canine Crime Squad. We also have a Canine Crime Squad of our own. Keep up the good work. Love from Arlington. Heart.
Oh my gosh, that is so awesome. And I believe that... Well, I can't remember now because we've had
read the daughter's review before. Yeah.
What was that it? Yeah. Or have we just had a couple different families?
We might have had a couple of different families at this point. Yeah.
Yeah. Either way, it's fantastic. And I love to hear that.
I love that parents are having bonding experiences with their children who are of appropriate age to be listening to this content, of course, over our show.
Yeah, I agree. It's pretty cool.
Anyways, that's all we got. So stay tuned to the show. We got another episode coming out real quick. I got one sitting in the chamber for you.
All right, guys. Another one is done. We're going to hang it on our shelf and call it a day, or at least we would like to, but we've got to now edit. That's going to be great.
You guys don't even know. So many weird mouth noises and breathiness from each other and strange dog noises that I have to edit out.
Ha, ha, ha. Dude, remember that bird that one time?
Dude, yeah, that bird. Jeez.
Anyways, okay, we're just delirious at this point.
Remember what we always say out here in the West. Crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.